This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Veronica Mars, The $1,000 Tan Line by Rob Thomas and Jennifer Graham. Read for you by Kristen Bell. Prologue. The buses began to roll into Neptune, California late Friday afternoon and didn't slow up until Monday. They arrived dusty, windshields speckled with dead insects and fractures from stray flying stones, the chaos of the interstate. They pulled in along the boardwalk, trembling with pent-up noise, shivering like dogs waiting for a command. Their routes mapped out an arterial network, connecting the little seaside town to all the university cities in the western United States, to L.A. and San Diego, to the Bay Area and the Inland Empire, to Phoenix, Tucson, Reno, to Portland and Seattle, to Boulder, to Boise, even to Provo. Bright, excited faces peered from every window, pressed to the glass. One after another, the bus's folding doors clattered open, and students poured out into the streets. They looked around at the sand and the surf, the carnival rides lit up along the boardwalk, the foot-tall drinks. Some had just finished term papers the night before. Others had stayed up all night studying for tests. Now, suddenly, they'd awakened in a fairyland that had popped into existence, just for their pleasure. Screaming with laughter, they flooded the town. They stumbled through the streets, blind, drunk, trusting that the magic that had brought them here would keep them from falling. And for exactly 3 nights, it did. By Wednesday morning, the coastal town that sparkled at night looked mundane. Not just mundane, dirty. Pools of spilled beer collected in the seams of the sidewalk, and the rank tang of overfilled dumpsters wafted out from the alleys. The ghostly forms of used condoms littered doorways and bushes, and shattered glass covered the street. The Sea Nymph Motel was eerily silent when 18-year-old Bree LaFond stumbled in. Almost all of the guests were spring breakers, and the party didn't get started until early afternoon. She had been at a rave on the inland edge of town, and by the time the party had wound down at 4 a.m., she hadn't been able to get a cab. She'd still been high enough that the idea of walking back to the motel had seemed feasible. Now, bone-tired, she trudged through the sandy courtyard to the room where she and her three best friends from UC Berkeley had rented. It was one of the cheapest available, facing the dumpster in the parking lot. Now she didn't care, fumbling with the lock and wanting only to fall into one of the two doubles they'd been sharing all week. The room's blinds gaped open, letting in a ray of pallid light. Leah sprawled across the bed with her head shoved under a pillow, still wearing a sequined dress from the night before. Her legs were bruised and smudged with dirt. Melanie sat with her back to the headboard, sipping from a paper Starbucks cup. She wore board shorts and a bikini top, her long blonde hair tousled and smears of makeup caking her eyes. She looked up when she heard the door open.
"I have a surf lesson in, like, half an hour, and I'm still drunk," she said.
She looked at Bree, her eyes focusing with difficulty.
"Where have you been? You look like shit."
"Thanks a lot." Bree leaned down to unzip her boots, her feet throbbing. "Where's Haley? Is she surfing too?"
"Haven't seen her."
Melanie closed her eyes and rested her head back against the wall. Bree froze, one boot off, the other still pinching her toes. She looked up. "Since when?"
Since the party on Monday, I guess."
Melanie opened her eyes.
"Shit."
Bree blinked, then tugged the other boot off her foot. She sank to the bed and gently pushed Leah's shoulder. "Hey, Leah, wake up. Did you see Haley yesterday?" Leah gave a low moan from under the pillow. For a moment, she curled into a tight ball, her arms circled protectively over her head. It took them a few more minutes of prodding and cooing her name before she finally pulled away the pillow and looked blearily up at them.
"Haley? Not since the party on Monday."
A bleak, empty feeling expanded into every corner of Bree's body. She scrolled back through her messages. There was nothing from Haley since Monday afternoon. "Invited to a party in a mansion tonight. Wanna go?"
They'd spent 3 hours getting ready, Haley wearing an uncharacteristically low-cut tight dress that showed miles of smooth tan leg. She kept insisting they look their best. She'd been invited by some guy who bought her a Mai Tai in the Cabo Cantina and told her to bring her hottest friends. They'd all gone, walking up a winding private road where a pair of burly security guards waved them in. The house was sprawling and modern, a boxy, sculptural structure. Every room burned with light and luxury. Melanie melted into the crowd instantly, gyrating her hips to the music. In the kitchen, Leah caught sight of a guy from her biology class and beelined towards him. Haley and Bree pushed through the house to the back patio to get their bearings. An enormous pool glowed aquamarine below them, and out beyond that, the beach stretched black in the moonlight. Haley's eyes shone, reflecting the bright-colored lights of the patio. All weekend she had alternated between sadness and outraged defiance. She'd be in tears one minute. The next, she'd spin on her heel to face one of her friends and snap, "Chad can't tell me what to do. Who does he think he is?" She and her boyfriend had broken up for the 100th time, but that night Haley looked excited. It was almost as if all the heartbreak had sloughed off her body, like some kind of heavy cocoon, leaving her raw and fresh and new. She and Bree had thrown themselves into the mass of dancing bodies, and for a while, the thrumming bass cleared all thoughts from Bree's head. She lost track of time, the number of drinks she threw back, and her friends. Now Bree remembered seeing Leah doing lines of coke off an antique coffee table, holding her long, honey-colored hair off her neck as she bent over. She remembered hands running up her hips, a slurring male voice telling her she'd be really hot if she grew her hair out. She remembered seeing flashes of Haley, leaning up to whisper in the ear of a boy in a perfectly cut white suit, his eyes long-lashed and sultry, his lips pouting playfully. Beyond that, everything was a blur. She'd woken up the next morning in a lawn chair by the motel pool, shivering in the early morning chill, her purse tucked under her head. She had no idea how she'd gotten home. "Did you see her leave the party with someone?" Bree looked at her friends. Both shook their heads slowly. "I'm sure she's fine," Melanie said hesitantly. "She's probably with some guy she met at the party, and she'll come up for air sooner or later."
"But we promised we'd check in with each other at least once a day. We promised!"
Bree's voice was shriller than she'd meant for it to sound. They'd made a pact on the way down that no matter what they were up to, no matter how much fun they were having, they'd look out for one another. The dark, empty feeling in her gut yawned even wider. She opened her text window and typed a new message. "Where are you? Come meet us for breakfast. Text back ASAP." All they had to do was wait. Melanie was probably right. Haley had lost track of time, just like they all had. She was somewhere out there having the time of her life. Still, when Leah and Melanie got up to go to breakfast, Bree shook her head no, her phone clenched in her hand. She sat alone in the motel room, shivering but too tired to change her clothes. She texted Haley again, and again. "Stop being selfish and respond, Haley. Everyone's worried about you. Text me." "That's it. If we don't hear from you in 10 minutes, we're calling the cops. Totally serious. Please answer. Please." Chapter 1. "And what about this one?" Veronica Mars sat in a hard plastic chair in the neurologist's office, one leg crossed over the other, her motorcycle boot jogging up and down as she listened to her father's exam. Keith Mars sat at a small table across from his doctor, watching as she flipped flashcards one by one with careful, deliberate movements. "Wheelbarrow," he said without hesitation. Dr. Subramanian didn't nod or shake her head, but, poker-faced, set the card down to her left. The neurologist's office was cool and dim, lit by the cozy glow of floor lamps instead of the usual harsh overhead fluorescence of most medical offices.
It always felt like early evening in here. Veronica pretended to be interested in a 4-month-old red book, her eyes skating over a feature titled, 20 Hostess Gifts for Under $20. And this? Alligator. Veronica glanced at her father and the titanium cane that leaned against his leg. It had been 2 months since the car crash that almost killed him. Keith had been meeting with Deputy Jerry Sachs about corruption within the sheriff's department when a van had broadsided them, then doubled back to hit them once more. Sachs had died, and Keith escaped only because Logan Eccles managed to pull him from the car before it exploded. The official story, or at least the one Sheriff Dan Lamb had fed to the media, was that Sachs had been on the take from a local meth dealer named Danny Sweet, and the van had been sent to kill Sachs after the deputy allowed 3 of Sweet's soldiers to get taken in on trafficking charges. It was crap, but the local news outlets didn't seem inclined to look any deeper. Veronica had been trying to get her father to talk about the crash since the night it happened, but Keith was maddeningly cagey about the details, saying it was my case, not yours. It had almost become a game between them. Every time she'd try to draw him out, guessing at who might have been behind the wheel, Lamb, another deputy, someone else entirely, he'd casually bat her guess away. All he'd tell her was that the murderer had been after Sachs, not after him, and to let it go.
"Candle, ring, umbrella," Keith said loudly.
Veronica examined her father. The violent purple bruises that had blossomed across his body had faded, but the real injuries, the broken ribs, the cracked pelvis, the torn liver, were still mending. He'd suffered a fractured skull, a subdural hematoma, and a mild cerebral contusion, and for a few weeks after the accident, his reaction times had been slow. In the first days after he'd stabilized, he'd had trouble with word retrieval, sometimes floundering for a few seconds before he could speak. Now he answered most of Dr. Subramanian's questions quickly and firmly. Word by word, Veronica saw him sit up straighter, like he was actually healing himself by getting the flashcards right.
"Very good, Mr. Moss."
The doctor's Oxford-accented voice was clipped, but pleased. She offered a rare smile, straightening the edges of her flashcards. Veronica put down the magazine.
"So what's the verdict, Doc? Is he good as new? Can we take him out for a test drive?"
Dr. Subramanian turned to give her a stern look over the tops of her wire-framed glasses. She wore her gray-streaked hair in a bun and sported a shade of lipstick Veronica had to believe was called no-nonsense. Veronica liked her.
"Good as new is not the phrase I'd use, but I'm pleased with his progress. How's your reaction time, Mr. Moss?"
"Lightning fast," Keith said, feigning a quick draw from his pocket.
"Any mood swings, strange behaviors, non sequiturs?"
She turned toward Veronica.
"No more than usual,"
Veronica smiled at her father.
"Hmm."
Dr. Subramanian looked down at the file folder in her hand.
"How's everything else healing up? It looks like you met with your internist earlier this week."
"He says I'm not about to run any marathons, but I could probably sit quietly at a desk organizing paper clips. I'd like to get back to work as soon as possible,"
Keith said, straightening his jacket. Every day since he'd gotten out of the hospital, he'd made a point of getting dressed in a crisp, pressed shirt and tie as if he were going to the office.
"Hmm."
The doctor slid open a manila envelope and pulled out several grainy MRI images, which she pinned up to a light box. Then she snapped on the light and grabbed a laser pointer attached to a set of keys.
"Well, the brain scans came back looking much improved. The swelling is almost completely gone, as you can see here."
Relief blurred Veronica's vision, the image of her father's healing brain disappearing into a myopic smear. She dabbed surreptitiously at her eyes. It was only now that he was so definitively on the mend that she understood how terrified she'd been at the idea that her father could be taken from her that easily. He was all the family she had. Each morning she woke up with an ache in the pit of her stomach, waiting for things to get back to normal. Because normal's the watchword, isn't it? She smiled a little to herself. Nothing in her life had been normal since she'd come back to Neptune after 9 long and quiet, normal years away. As a teenager, she'd wanted only to get away, to flee the confines of a town run by the moneyed and the corrupt, to flee the scars of her youth. And she'd done it, for a while at least. She'd left, first to Stanford, and then to Columbia Law. The life she'd put together for herself had looked pretty good. Hole-in-the-wall Brooklyn apartment in spitting distance of Prospect Park. A job offer from Truman Mann, where she'd have a chance to learn from some of the fiercest lawyers in New York. Cute, talented, even-keeled boyfriend named Piz. But she'd left it all behind. It had taken only one call to pull her back to Neptune. When Logan, her high school boyfriend, had been wrongly accused of his ex-girlfriend's murder, Veronica had dropped her entire life and rushed home to prove his innocence. She'd discovered the real murderer and reclaimed a part of her that she'd lost, the piece that knew she was meant to be a private investigator, not a lawyer. And she'd also found Logan again. Now he was her, what, new old boyfriend? Lover? Skype buddy? Pen pal with benefits? Whatever his title, his emails filled her inbox. Sometimes he sent 5 a day, short and quipping. Other times he sent longer, more serious ones. She kept her tone light when she replied. That had always been her MO, a joke, a jab. A way to deflect from what she was really feeling. A way to keep the nonstop ache of missing him from becoming too painful to survive. And honestly, what was there to say that would come close to what she felt? The moments they'd spent together before he'd shipped out on his latest naval tour had been the most peaceful she could remember, even with her anxiety about her dad. It had been the first time she'd felt complete in a long time. And then, just like that, he was gone again. So I would like you to give it maybe 2 more weeks just to be extra sure, and then yes, as long as you commit to starting slow, you can start light duty at work. Dr. Subramanian's voice came floating back to her. But, Miss Mars, I'm putting you in charge of making sure he does not overextend himself. If he makes a sudden move toward anything too strenuous, you have my permission to send him home. You hear that? Veronica pointed at Keith. Mars Investigations just got itself a brand new low-paid intern. Copies, coffee, and mail, my friend. He clasped his hands together. I've been training for this moment all my life. She forced a smile. Despite their banter, a vague sense of unease tightened in Veronica's chest. Of course she was relieved that her father would be able to get back to work soon. She knew how important his job was to him. Back when she was in high school, she'd worked at his private investigation firm, Mars Investigations. Officially, she'd been his receptionist. Unofficially, she'd taken all the cases he hadn't had time for. But now she had to wonder what it would be like when they had to go into the office together. Would they run tape down the middle of the room, a la I Love Lucy? Would they be able to wedge another desk in there? She imagined a toy-size pink plastic desk next to his, a sticker reading, Fisher Price's My First Office Furniture, stuck to one corner. Her sitting with her knees to her chest, typing furiously on a pretend computer while her father looked fondly on. It was ridiculous. They had worked together before, after all, but he was none too happy about her decision to forego a lucrative career with a law firm for a life of following philanderers with a zoom lens. For the past few months, he'd been able to pretend she was there to help him in his convalescence, but more and more she sensed him rankle at the mention of her work. If she told him she'd been out late on a stakeout, or brought up something funny or strange she'd noticed in a case, he became quiet and looked away quickly, like she'd just embarrassed herself and he was embarrassed too. He couldn't understand why she'd come back. Some days, she didn't understand it either. Neptune was still the same glittering, dirty seaside town, like a tarnished bronze angel looking out over a graveyard. But the moment she'd started working on Logan's case, she'd felt her desire to investigate, to discover the truth in a tangle of lies pulling at her, like an undertow. A few minutes later, they stepped out into the mild sunshine together. For a moment, she watched him from the corner of her eye, noticing the way his mouth tightened as they went down the three steps to the parking lot. Keith Mars was a short, stocky man, mostly bald, his dark hair a low wreath around the sides of his head. His heavy jaw was usually in danger of a 5 o'clock shadow by noon. He looked like a cop, she thought, smiling a little. It had been 8 years since he'd last worn the uniform, but he'd always looked like a cop to her.
How does it feel to be one step closer to prime fighting condition?
He tapped the pavement ironically with his cane.
Getting there. One limping, minuscule step at a time.
Hey, she nudged him gently.
Play your cards right, and I'll even let you clean the fish tank.
Logan's sleek midnight blue BMW convertible stood out in a parking lot chock full of mid-sized sedans. He'd insisted on loaning it to her during his deployment.
I'm gonna be stuck on a giant tin can in the Persian Gulf for the next 6 months. What good's it gonna do me?
She tried to protest. It cost more than she could expect to make in the next few years. But sliding into the car always gave her a little thrill. And it wasn't just that the dashboard looked like that of a spaceship and the leather interior was soft as a cherub's backside. A faint smell, warm and woodsy, lingered in the driver's seat, the distant notes of Logan's aftershave. And when she curled her fingers around the steering wheel, she could almost feel his hands there, under hers.
You're losing your edge, Mars, she told herself as Keith buckled in. You don't have the luxury of acting like some love-struck teenager anymore.
Besides, they were already 2.5 months in. Only 112 days to go, and Logan would be back. Chapter 2 Traffic was already a nightmare by the time Veronica dropped her dad off at home and headed back out toward Mars investigations. Spring break had descended on Neptune in all its bacchanalian glory, and even though the worst of it had choked the beaches and the boardwalks, the party had spread inland, creeping up through the commercial districts and the historic downtown blocks. The drunk and disoriented glutted the bars, restaurants, and shops all over town, even at noon on a Monday. It had already been going on for more than a week, and it wouldn't slow up until mid-April. There were hundreds of colleges within driving distance, each with its own spring break dates. Veronica glanced in her rearview mirror. Traffic stretched as far as she could see, motionless in the sun. The sidewalks were crawling with undergrads, shouting at their friends, lifting glass bottles in impromptu toasts. Apparently, Neptune's public consumption laws were being selectively enforced. But that was par for the course during the 3-week spring break season. Money talked in Neptune, and no one heard it louder or clearer than Sheriff Dan Lamb. He spent most of the year chasing undesirables, translation, anyone flirting with the poverty line, off the streets, only to turn a blind eye to binge-drinking 18-year-olds descending en masse. Someone laid on his horn. A girl with feather hair extensions leaned down into the gutter to vomit, then straightened up and kept walking as if nothing had happened. A cluster of bikini-clad girls on roller skates tripped, laughing across the road while several boys stood on the sidewalk filming them with their cell phones. She sighed and fiddled with the radio dial. She'd let Keith man the stations on the way home, and now Blue Oyster Cult blared from the speakers, the cowbell ringing loud and proud. 500 stations on this thing, and he went straight to 1976. There's no help for some people. She played idly with the controls, looking for something to pass the time.
I can tell you one thing, I wouldn't let my daughter go to Neptune for spring break.
Veronica paused. She knew that voice right away. Trish Turley, big, blonde, and Texan, sounded like an avenging fury cutting across the airwaves. Her TV show ran daily on CNN, and Neptune's local talk radio streamed the audio.
I mean, the place is just a pressure cooker of hormones, drugs, and alcohol. Kids these days aren't taught to respect their own limits. And have you seen the way these girls act?
You could practically see Trish Turley shaking her head in approbation.
All you have to do is look up Neptune in your World Wide Web and you'll find video upon video of them showing their breasts for free beer. And then we're shocked when someone gets hurt. Ah, the twin pillars of outrage journalism. Slut-shaming and victim-blaming. Trish Turley liked to call herself a victim's rights advocate. But any time she could turn an eye on the general decay of society, as witnessed through wasp-colored glasses, she made sure to cover all the bases. The corruption of youth? Check. Amoral decadence? Check. Missing white girl? Yahtzee. But even Veronica had to admit that it was disturbing how little difference 18-year-old Haley DeWalt's disappearance had made to the festivities. The news had hit that weekend. Haley, down with friends from UC Berkeley, had been missing for almost a week. But you'd never have guessed it from the air of celebration hanging over the town. The bass pounded on and the beer still flowed freely. She wasn't sure what the reaction to one of their own vanishing into thin air should be. But the Spring Breakers' blind and blissful determination to carry on as if nothing bad could happen to them surprised even her. She wasn't sure she'd ever had that invincible, indestructible air, even when she'd been younger. And then there's this Keystone cop sheriff. That caught her attention. She turned the radio up a little. This Dan Lamb character? What a joker. Who goes on national TV in the post-Natalie Holloway world to say we shouldn't worry about a missing teenage girl? I hope that the DeWalt family has a good lawyer on the books. A lawsuit might just get Lamb's attention. A slow smile spread over Veronica's face. Trish, Trish, Trish. We have so little in common, and yet suddenly I have a powerful urge to kiss you. She'd been watching Lamb for the past few months, waiting for any opportunity to nail him to the wall, but if he kept this up, he'd do it himself. The video Veronica had sent to TMZ had started the ball rolling, of course. She'd caught Lamb on tape talking about the Bonnie DeVille murder case, saying, "I don't care if Logan Eccles ain't the guy. America thinks he's guilty, and that's good enough for me." That little snippet had hit the airwaves hard. Lamb had an election in 8 months, and for the first time, his re-election was a less than sure bet. The town's wealthiest residents still supported him. Lamb looked after their interests, after all. But his approval ratings had taken a nosedive in the past few months. "Let's listen to this guy's statement when the press finally cornered him Friday afternoon," Turley continued. The sound quality changed. Wind crackled against a cheap recorder. Sheriff Dan Lamb's voice was calm, but there was no mistaking the hint of impatience. "We are definitely on the lookout for Miss DeWalt, but as far as we can tell, there's no evidence of foul play. At this time, we are not conducting a criminal investigation, nor are we conducting a missing person search. Look," he said, his voice rising over the sudden murmur of a crowd, "this happens every year. Kids get separated from their friends, they overindulge, they forget to check in, and everyone panics. Then they turn up a few days later, safe and sound. There's absolutely no safety problem here in Neptune." Some part of Lamb must have realized it was a bad idea to answer questions off the cuff about a missing girl, but he had a pathological inability to turn down media attention. It clearly ran in the family. His brother, Don, who'd been the sheriff when Veronica had been in high school, had been cut from the same cloth. And now Lamb's soundbites had been playing on repeat through the weekend, making Neptune Sheriff's Department look cavalier and incompetent. The traffic started to move again. Veronica eased the car forward, narrowly missing two girls who had stopped in the middle of the street to light each other's cigarettes. They both held up their middle fingers in perfect unison. Veronica cheerfully flipped them off in return, then took a right toward Neptune's warehouse district. The red brick building that housed Mars Investigations had been a brewery at the turn of the 20th century, but in the past decade it had been subdivided into lofts and offices. Veronica was still getting used to it. Back when she'd worked as her dad's receptionist in high school, the office had been in a modest commercial district, surrounded by bookstores and Chinese takeout joints,
But when the O'Niner, an exclusive new nightclub, opened just down the street from their old location, rent had shot through the roof, effectively gentrifying her dad's one-man operation right out of the neighborhood. Rent here was more manageable. Though if she didn't land a good case soon, it still wouldn't be manageable enough. The Mars Investigations logo, a modified Eye of Providence with horizontal lines across the triangle, hung over the door to the walk-up, etched in glass. Veronica climbed the creaking stairs. The place had an old building smell, dry and dusty and warm. At the top of the landing, she pushed through the double doors to the outer office. The room was neat but shabby. Light streamed through the blinds, falling in long bars across the floor. The walls were a deep taupe shade that took on a brooding tone in the shadows. The color had been picked for its cheapness rather than aesthetic qualities. A thrift store sofa sat beneath the hallway windows, a dusty rubber plant in the corner. Across from their color copier, a fish tank burbled quietly. Cindy McKenzie sat at the reception desk, watching Trish Turley on the biggest of the three monitors on her desk. Mac's short stock of brown hair fell over one eye, and a slouchy gray sweater hung from one narrow shoulder. Veronica and Mac had been friends since their junior year at Neptune High. They'd been drawn together by Mac's hacking skills, but it was their mutual misanthropy that had sealed the deal. Mac looked up as Veronica shrugged out of her leather jacket, hanging it on a coat rack by the door. "Morning, boss." "Boss?" Veronica widened her eyes. "Did I start paying you?" "No," Mac said, her eyes darting back to her screen. "But it's also not really morning." "I think thousands of spring breakers would disagree with you," Veronica said. "Touché." A few months earlier, Mac had left a secure job at Kane Software to work with Veronica at Mars Investigations. The pay at Kane had been great, but the job itself was a little too bland for a self-proclaimed digital outlaw. Finding new and creative ways to dig up dirt for Veronica's clients was much more her speed. The title they'd been tossing around had been Technical Analyst, but at this point it seemed mostly philosophical. The caseload had been dry for weeks, and the few gigs they'd had been completely lowbrow. Cheating spouses, fraudulent insurance claims, due diligence investigations, things Veronica could easily have managed by herself. "Did you see Neptune made the news?" Mac nodded at her monitor and turned up the volume. Turley's enormous hair filled the better part of the screen, a stiff blonde bouffant that didn't budge when she moved. The woman's eyes blazed as she spoke, enunciating every word with righteous indignation. "I'd like to encourage anyone who can to donate to the Find Haley Fund. If this sheriff's not going to find her, it's up to us, viewers." "The fund is up to nearly $400,000, and it's only been a few days," Mac said. Veronica whistled. "Well, Trish Turley may be an opportunistic parasite thriving off our broken criminal justice system, but she sure can throw a booster sale." She sank down into the threadbare couch and rested her head back against the wall. "Next year, let's go somewhere for spring break, Mac. Anywhere college kids aren't puking. Someplace with no booze." "Next year, spring break in Tehran. I'm booking it now," Mac said, not even looking up from her computer. "How's your dad?"
"Good. The doc says just a few more weeks and he can do some light-duty work. He can't wait to get back in here."
"Catastrophic injuries are wasted on some people," Mac shook her head. "If I'd ruptured every single one of my organs, I'd be milking it for everything it was worth." Veronica stared at a long crack that zigzagged like a constellation across the ceiling. She distantly realized she'd have to call the landlord about it. But talking to Sven about the shitty roof would necessitate talking to Sven about the rent, which was 3 days late. She exhaled loudly and closed her eyes. "You may have noticed that another Friday has come and gone and your bank balance is nonetheless unchanged," she started. Mac cut her off. "It's okay, Veronica. I know things have been tight." Veronica opened her eyes and smiled weakly. "Mac, I'm so sorry. This isn't how I imagined any of this."
"Hey," Mac said chidingly. We both knew there was a chance it wouldn't work. Look, I've already started looking around for another paying gig, just to cover my bills, you know? And I can still come in as, like, a consultant next time you need me. She gave a lopsided grin. Of course, my prices are double for consulting. Of course, Veronica smiled. But inside, she was cringing. It wasn't just that she was letting Mac down, but on top of that, she worried there'd never be another case complicated enough to require Mac's technical savvy. She'd worked for her dad long enough to know the truth about the PI game. For every high-profile case, for every Sherlock-level puzzle, there were 100 boring, petty cases, and she was barely scoring the latter. Was this really what she'd chosen? Over New York? Over a corporate law job where she'd be pulling in six figures? Before bonus time? Well, at this rate, it wouldn't last much longer. Unless something changed, she'd bring Mars Investigations and all her father's work crashing down around her. As if on cue, the door swung open. In walked a woman with chestnut curls flaring out from her high cheekbones and a light wool suit tailored to fit her ample curves. Her stiletto heels rang sharply against the floor as she strode forward. She moved with heavy, almost sultry grace. Her dark, velvety eyes made a circuit of the room before finally coming to rest on the couch where Veronica sat. "I'm looking for Keith Mars," she said. "I need his help." Chapter 3. Veronica struggled to her feet, mentally swearing at the sagging couch. There was no way to stand gracefully. She ended up doing an undignified little hop to catch her balance. "Mr. Mars is actually on leave of absence right now. I'm covering his caseload." She held out her hand, and the woman hesitated for a moment before shaking it. "I'm Veronica Mars."
"Petra Landros."
Her voice was low and musical, with the faintest trace of an accent. Veronica sized her up quickly, a detached, calculating part of her brain rapidly punching numbers. Armani suit, Jimmy Choo's, diamonds in the earlobes, diamonds on the fingers, crow's feet just starting to crease the corners of her eyes, but a body that was clearly the result of dark magic, Pilates, or severely restrictive undergarments. She looked vaguely familiar. Most important, she looked wealthy, like an opportunity to keep the lights on another week, especially with Veronica's special sliding scale rich bitch rates. Petra frowned.
"I'm sorry, how long did you say Mr. Mars would be out of the office?"
"He'll be gone for the next few months." Well, he wouldn't be in any shape to go peeping through windows before then, so it wasn't a complete lie. "But let me reassure you that we are committed to delivering the same excellent service that we've always provided to our clients, even in his absence."
"And by we, you mean you, right?"
Landros gave her a skeptical look. Veronica had seen that look before, especially from female clients. It usually meant she was about to lose a job. Back when she'd been an amateur, the fact that she didn't look the part had been an asset. It kept people off their guard, gave her freedom of movement. But now that she was the face of the operation, it was rapidly becoming clear that her petite frame and blonde hair didn't exactly win the confidence of her clients. A sudden flare of irritation shot through her. Before she could stop herself, she gestured at the window. "You see that sign that says Mars Investigations? Well, that's me. I'm Mars, so yes, I mean me." Behind Landros, Veronica caught a glimpse of Mac pretending to hit her head on the desk. "Maybe we need to hire a people person," she thought, her heart sinking slightly. But when she turned back, the woman looked amused.
"I know who you are, Miss Mars. You're the woman who brought Bonnie DeVille's killer to justice, and you humiliated the sheriff on national television."
Veronica shrugged. "Lamb humiliated himself. I just made sure he got airtime." Landros gave her a wry smile.
"Yes, well, that's the attitude that makes me wish your father were available. From what I've heard, he's more discreet, but the situation being what it is..."
Then a business card was in Veronica's hand, and she had to fight to keep her jaw from dropping. Embossed along the left of the card was the red and gold logo of the Neptune Grand Hotel. Typed under Petra Landros's name, it read simply, Owner. And that was when she realized why the woman was so familiar. Petra Landros, the one-time underwear model who'd married the premier boutique hotelier in Southern California. Veronica remembered seeing her picture in the glossy magazines she and her high school best friend Lily Kane once pored over by the pool, pouting in a diamond-studded demi-bra. For a few years, she'd been the trophy wife Veronica had assumed her to be, until her husband had died in a tragic skiing accident at the age of 46, and then, to everyone's surprise, she'd taken over the company. At first, the whole thing was treated like a bad local joke, but if Landros's feelings were hurt, she was crying her way to the bank. She'd not only increased the Grand's profits, she'd bought up a good chunk of the boardwalk and started construction on two new restaurants. Plus, she'd elbowed her deceased husband's own brother off the board with a ruthlessness that would make Leona Helmsley blush. In other words, Veronica's rates had just gone up dramatically. "Why don't you step into my office?" Veronica gestured to the open door. Veronica's office, Keith's office, was brighter than the outer room, with two large windows facing east and south. The walls had been painted a sunny yellow, and her father's model ships rested along the windowsills and on top of the filing cabinets. Landros walked ahead of Veronica, sitting down in one of the low chairs and crossing her long legs. Veronica had just enough time to exchange baffled glances with Mac before shutting the door behind her. "So, what can I do for you?" Veronica walked around the desk to sit in her father's low leather chair. Sunlight streamed through the big window behind the desk, catching every diamond Landros wore so that she glittered with each gesture.
"I'm actually here on behalf of Neptune's Chamber of Commerce. You may have seen the news this weekend."
The woman pursed her full lips.
"Our beloved sheriff has created something of a PR nightmare."
"You're talking about Haley DeWalt's disappearance?" Landros sighed.
"Of course. We asked Lam to keep everyone calm. Instead, he managed to make us look like a town of callous sociopaths. And now, Trish Turley has her teeth in the story, telling parents not to let their kids go to Neptune for spring break."
Veronica's eyebrows shot upward. "I see. So you wanted Lam to downplay Haley's disappearance, but not in a way that made it look like you care more about tourism dollars than, say, a teenage girl's life."
"You're really not a saleswoman, are you?"
Landros raised one perfectly groomed eyebrow. Her chair creaked slightly as she shifted her weight.
"Look, I won't bullshit you, Miss Mars. My hotel and the tourism industry here in Neptune make almost 40% of the total annual income during spring break. It's not a piece of the pie we can afford to lose. So yes, we want this disappearance handled with some delicacy. But that doesn't mean we don't also want to find Haley."
Veronica leaned back in her chair, glancing out the window. Even from the comparative quiet of the office, she could hear the thrumming of car radios, the peals of shrill laughter, the sounds of breaking glass from the commercial streets a few blocks away.
"It doesn't sound like you're losing too much business."
"A few city blocks of teenagers do not a spring break make," Landros said calmly. "This crowd is nothing compared to last year. We've had hundreds of cancellations over the weekend alone. That's not just hundreds of canceled rooms, but hundreds of drinks that won't be ordered, hundreds of meals that won't be eaten, hundreds of swimsuits and flip-flops that won't be purchased, hundreds of scuba masks and kayaks and scooters that won't be rented. And every day Turley is out there telling parents that Neptune is unsafe, telling them that their daughters will be kidnapped or raped or murdered if they set foot in the city limits."
"So you want me to
find Haley DeWalt?"
Veronica gave her a long, flat look.
"Isn't this what the sheriff's office should be doing?"
Petra leaned forward, looking Veronica hard in the eye.
Do you honestly think Lam will be the one to find her?
Does this mean the Chamber of Commerce is retracting their endorsement of Sheriff Lam? Veronica asked sweetly. Landros pursed her lips. Veronica read the answer in the woman's face. Lam, inept as he was just too handy for the COC to cast away. He looked after their interests too well. They'd fund his campaign even while hiring Veronica to do the real police work. To them, it was worth the expense.
Will you do it?
Landros asked, avoiding the question. Veronica listened to the roar of the crowd. Somewhere at the back of her mind, she could see Haley DeWalt, the clean-scrubbed brunette whose face had been on every TV station since last week, and felt a sharp pang. She hadn't known Haley DeWalt, but she'd known girls like her. My rate is $200 an hour plus expenses. I'll need a daily retainer of $700 for the duration of the case. If I find Haley, I keep all associated reward money in addition to my fee. Veronica's voice was hard and flat. She laced her fingers together in front of her chin. She didn't have the luxury of examining her motivations too closely. If there was that much money at stake, the chamber would pay. And if she could find a missing girl in the process of keeping her father's business open, even better. They eyed each other across the desk for a moment. The light from the window caught on Landros's left earring, and for a moment it was so overwhelmingly bright Veronica had to blink. Finally, Landros nodded.
Not a saleswoman, but certainly a businesswoman, she smiled. All right, Miss Mars, you have a deal.
Veronica pulled a pen from the barrel-shaped holder on the desk. What do you know about the case? Where was Haley last seen?
At a party up on Manzanita Drive. None of the girls she was with seems to know whose house it was, but according to Lam, it belongs to a rental agency. He's supposed to be looking into who had it rented.
She brushed a lock of hair behind her ear with a careless hand.
I've donated the main conference room of the Neptune Grand for the search efforts. We've also set up a website for tips and donations to help fund the search. You've probably heard Trish Turley talking about it. It's pulled in nearly $500,000 in 3 days, and it doesn't show signs of slowing down. We've siphoned off $10,000 as reward money, so if you do find Haley, there's an extra incentive for you.
Where's her family staying?
I have them in one of the business suites. They can put you in touch with the friends who were with Haley at the time.
Have there been any tips yet? Anything credible? Landros snorted.
The usual disgusting pranks. If I had any particular faith in humanity, the messages I've seen come in from anonymous tipsters would have shaken it. So far, we've at least kept her parents from seeing them. We have volunteers filtering through the inbox.
She adjusted a delicate bracelet on her wrist.
I've set up a meeting with Sheriff Lam this afternoon. I'd like you to come.
Veronica tapped her pen lightly on the desk. I'm not exactly his favorite person.
Neither am I.
Her smile was a tight, humorless curve on her face.
But you're technically working in tandem on this case, and I want to make sure it goes as smoothly as possible. Besides, he can bring you up to speed on the details better than I can.
She stood up. For a moment, Veronica could picture what she must have been like on a runway. Hips pivoting to the beat of a cranked-up techno soundtrack, feather wings strapped to her back in a pure white spray. She fought a smile. This was a woman who'd figured out how to be fearless, even standing in her underwear. Landros smoothed her skirt.
I need to get back to work. Have your girl email me the contract and I'll have it in your inbox by the end of the day.
Of course. Veronica followed Landros to the front door and opened it for her. The woman paused for a moment, then turned to face her.
Do me a favor, though, Miss Mars. Please do try to keep a low profile on this. We want answers, not theater.
Veronica smiled. Understood. They shook hands once more. Then Petra Landros was gone. Veronica pivoted slowly around. Max sat at her desk, her mouth hanging slack. Their eyes met, and Veronica couldn't help it. She grinned. Feel like working for Mars Investigations a little longer?
Mac's cheeks flushed with dawning excitement.
We've got a case.
A big one. She strode across the room and leaned down on Mac's desk to look at her, face to face.
I'm going to need background checks on Haley DeWalt's immediate family members, along with Haley's phone records and emails for the past few months. But first things first. Where are we ordering lunch from today? Because I'm starving. And Neptune is buying.
Chapter 4. Later that afternoon, Veronica pulled up in front of the regal brick and sandstone entrance of the Neptune Grand. She handed the BMW's keys to a valet in a pillbox hat and pushed through the enormous revolving door. The lobby glinted with brass and brocade, the low trill of jazz piano wafting from the speakers overhead. The Neptune Grand had undergone some changes in the past few years. Petra Landros had built a gleaming tower on the north side of the courtyard, 10 stories higher than the original structure, with a glass-sided elevator looking down over the luxurious gardens below. But here, in the old Grand, the lobby looked the same as it ever had, with cream-colored walls and marble surfaces. Veronica had spent the better part of her senior year in this place, first visiting her old boyfriend Duncan Kane in his penthouse suite, and later, Logan. Reception wasn't nearly as busy as she would have expected for the Monday of spring break. A few girls with silk caftans draped over their swimsuits bounced out of the elevators, and a bored-looking boy wearing Gucci shades and a UCLA sweatshirt leaned against the reception desk waiting for his key. The Neptune Grand wasn't generally spring break central. Only the trust-funded would be able to afford a room there during peak season, but true to Petra's word, it felt strangely quiet. Veronica took the elevator to the 9th floor, then followed the red and gold chevron print carpet to room 902 and knocked softly. From the other side of the door, she could just make out a female voice, low and muffled. After a moment, the door swung open, and a woman stood in the doorway. She was short and plump, wearing a UC Berkeley sweatshirt that was 2 sizes too big. Her hair had been dyed a brassy blonde, but the roots, dull brown with a few threads of gray, were starting to peek out. Ruddy bags were stamped underneath her eyes, and her face had the moist, crumpled look of someone who had been crying too much. She gave Veronica a weak, tentative smile as she stepped back from the door.
"You're the private investigator?"
Her voice was high-pitched, a little bit girlish.
"I'm Margie, Haley's mom."
"Yes, Veronica Mars. I'm so sorry for all you're going through, Mrs. DeWalt." Veronica stuck out her hand. Margie looked at Veronica's fingers with a distant, wondering expression. Veronica was just about to let her hand fall awkwardly back to her side when Haley's mother grasped it and shook her head.
"I'm so sorry. I'm exhausted. Come on in."
The suite was laid out like a small luxury apartment, decorated in tones of gray and red. The central room was a combination living room and kitchenette, separated by a small round dining table. A tall, bearded man in a flannel shirt sat at the table, nursing a cup of coffee. He barely looked up when Margie led Veronica into the room, his eyes distant and red-rimmed. Veronica recognized him as Mike DeWalt, Haley's dad, from the press conference they'd held last week. A young man, maybe 22 or 23, slouched on the scarlet sofa staring at a plasma screen TV on the wall. He was thick-set, with wide, muscular shoulders and the beginnings of a beer gut, his premature jowls bristling with unshaven growth. He held the remote against one knee, but seemed engrossed in a nature program where a wiry British man stood hip-deep in a muddy river, describing the way a tiger fish stripped its prey of flesh. On the other side of the couch sat a gangly-limbed teenager, her mousy brown hair long and limp around her face. She seemed intent on a hole in the knee of her blue jeans, probing it carefully with her fingertips.
"The investigator is here,"
Margie said. Only her husband looked up and nodded briefly at her.
"Miss March, did you say?"
"Mars." Veronica stood next to the kitchenette island, taking in the room. "But please, call me Veronica." She noticed a large digital picture frame plugged in at one end of the island. It cycled slowly through a number of pictures, one fading into the next.
small Haley DeWalt, riding a pink bike up a driveway. A preteen version with braces on her teeth and greasy bangs flattened across her forehead. One of her playing flute in what looked like a church. Another of her, older, in a cap and gown for graduation. She'd turned into a pretty girl, with dark hair and a sunny, easy smile that struck Veronica as unguarded, vulnerable. "You've got to put up your dukes, kid," she thought, though she wasn't sure if the advice was for Haley or herself.
"The investigator is here," Margie repeated more loudly.
The girl looked up from the couch, then back down at her jeans. The young man on the couch didn't respond.
"Turn off the goddamn TV!"
Mike DeWalt exploded, his voice furious and booming. Silently, slowly, the boy lifted the remote and turned off the TV just as the nature program cut to a clip of muscular fish thrashing around in a feeding frenzy. The screen went dark. For a moment, the silence in the room had weight. Margie covered her face with her hands. Veronica noticed that her fingernails were painted Easter egg blue, the polish chipped and cracked. Veronica pegged her as a classic self-proclaimed fun mom, the kind who thinks of herself as her daughter's best friend. Just like dear old mom. Veronica's alcoholic mother, Leanne, had been the same way before she walked out on their family. When Margie pulled her hands away from her face, she seemed calmer, her breath slow and careful. She pointed to the couch.
"That's Ella. She's Haley's little sister, and my stepson, Crane."
Ella pulled her knees up to her chin. Crane straightened up and looked at Veronica, his dark hazel eyes taking her in. Veronica placed her bag on the floor and sat in a small upholstered armchair facing both of them. "How are you guys holding up? You know, we're worried about our sister." Crane's eyes darted towards Margie as she sat down in another chair catty-corner from Veronica. It might just have been the way of his dealing with stress, but Crane's body was taut with pent-up energy. His knee jiggled up and down, and while he clasped his hands politely in his lap, the knuckles were white.
"Well, she's only my half-sister," he continued, "but I'm just as upset as everyone else."
Veronica pulled her notebook out of her purse and flipped it to a blank page. She clicked her pen a few times and then wrote, "If you have to say it out loud..." She didn't really need to take notes. She had a memory for details that was at best useful and at worst obsessive. But the little notebook was a good smokescreen during an interview. Too much direct eye contact made people nervous, cagey. This way, they didn't feel overly scrutinized, which loosened up their tongues. Now she glanced up and tapped the tip of her pen on her pad.
"What can you tell me about Haley? Anything you can share about her habits, her plans, and her personality might be helpful. I'm gonna try to retrace her steps in the next few days, so the more I know about her, the easier that will be."
Margie DeWalt rubbed her arms as if to warm them, though the room was actually quite stuffy.
She's a sweet girl."
A small, fluttering smile lit her mouth and then was gone.
"Friendly. Really social. She makes friends everywhere she goes. She's always been so easygoing, especially compared with her siblings."
She glanced at Ella with a look that was more sad than accusatory.
"Ella won't go to the mall with me anymore. Says only losers do that."
Ella drew in her breath audibly but didn't otherwise move. Veronica jotted, "out of touch," in her notebook.
"Did she have a lot of friends?" "Oh, yes, in high school she did. In college, I think she's had a harder time."
She pressed her lips together.
"I've met a few of the so-called friends that she came down here with. Two of them are always hovering around the conference room pretending they're torn up about Haley. But they didn't even realize she was gone until 2 days after they'd last seen her. If those were the best friends she had..."
She shook her head.
"Do you have their contact info? I'd like to talk to them," Veronica said.
She nodded.
"I'll get it for you." "What about a boyfriend? Was she seeing anyone?"
Margie frowned a little.
"I know she was dating. She sort of hinted at it. I don't think there was anyone serious, though. I mean, she would have told me if she were hearing wedding bells, you know."
"Would she, though?"
Veronica looked up from her notepad.
Did you know she was planning to come down for spring break?
The woman nodded.
Of course. I wanted her to come back to Billings for the week. I thought it'd be nice. She could see her old friends, spend some time.